And welcome to The Point. I'm Sean Corcoran, news director here at WCAI, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Welcome, Sean.
Good morning.
Sean's first appearance on The Point, one of many, I'm sure, and we're happy to have him. Joining us a little later will be Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Joshua Balling will call in. He's with the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and we'll hear from Jeff Spillane, a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. Sean, let's start with a story out of Plymouth. A tragedy at an elementary school there, one they're still trying to sort out, with involving a custodian was working in the school.
That's right. There was a hazmat situation on Monday at Manomet Elementary School in Plymouth, and it resulted in the death of that school custodian, Chester Flattery. Apparently, he was there doing some cleaning, doing some custodial work. There were no kids in the building, but he and a school secretary were overtaken by fumes, and emergency personnel responded, and 10 emergency responders and that secretary also ended up being hospitalized. But Mr. Flattery died, and they're not entirely sure why at this point.
I think I read a quotation from a fire chief saying that the chemical measurements in the school were low at the time, so that really adds to the mystery.
That's right. He was 53, so he was, you know, they're not sure if perhaps he had some sort of medical condition that was exacerbated by whatever he was doing or what happened, but it is a mystery, and they do have a lot of testing to do still, so it might be a while before we have any answers on that.
It's a toxicology situation?
Toxicology and testing, you know. Probably his body is part of the autopsy and whatever chemicals he was using and mixing together perhaps at that moment.
Well, it's a good thing certainly that there were no students in there, but what a difficult situation for the family. You expect someone heads off to work. That's
definitely
not what you expect
definitely
to hear. Let's talk about a story we've been following for several months now. Actually, we might be on years, regarding Joe Votto, who owns a fish store in Sandwich. Now, give us the background on this story. He found himself caught up in a police investigation.
He did. Well, George Brennan has been following this story for us, but he was caught up in a police investigation about some shellfish that he was selling from someone who didn't have a license, I believe. And the most recent development in this, of course, is that District Attorney Michael O'Keefe was asked by Votto's attorney to write a letter basically stating that he considered the matter settled, essentially, because of whatever punishment he got in Barnstable court. And that has upset some of the other, the oyster farmers who believe that maybe Mr. O'Keefe should not have been doing that on behalf of Mr. Votto.
I see. So to go back a little bit, there was an investigation when there were several shellfishing thefts across Cape Cod, and so police were investigating that. And during the course of the investigation, they saw one of the suspects go and allegedly sell stolen oysters, to Mr. Votto's business. And there was a guilty plea entered for that?
Yes, there was.
So there was a court case, and he was fined, I understand. And now it's the state that's looking at whether they want to pull the license of Joe's Lobster Mart in Sandwich. I mean, long-standing business there. Folks come. I've been in there before, and I've seen folks come in and ask them to pack up 20 lobsters and send them across the country. I mean, this is a real established place. And so now you're saying the district attorney was asked to write a letter essentially saying, okay, what do you think about the license being pulled?
Yeah, essentially what the letter was is it was outlining the fact that Mr. Votto didn't have any other violations with the district attorney's office, and that he got a punishment that Mr. O'Keefe's office felt was sufficient, and outlined the offenses and what the punishment was. And having read the letter, it's posted also online at our website, CapeCodOnline.com. It is straightforward, but there is still this question of other oyster farmers who were the victims of these thefts of, this is, a crime that was committed, and why are you essentially, they believe, advocating on his behalf.
So they're questioning whether this letter should have been written what they see as support of Mr. Votto, though perhaps the DA sees it a different way. They're just facts. This is what the punishment was.
Right, exactly.
I see. Oh, but this is a pretty political time for the district attorney of the Cape and Islands. He's going into an election. Has his opponent made any hay out of this?
Yeah, Richard Berry did send out a tweet earlier this week calling the letter cronyism, and then also sent out a press release criticizing O'Keefe for not seeking an indictment against Votto. And Mr. O'Keefe didn't see it as a political story, and he said he wasn't concerned about the political ramifications of what he's done.
Mm, I see. Okay, we'll continue to follow that story, and let's move on to a pretty serious story. I was surprised to see this in the paper this week concerning the water in the town of Falmouth.
That's right. That story I wrote, actually. So, head of the Board of Health in Falmouth, Jed Goldstone, reiterated at a recent meeting about potential dangers for women who are pregnant in their first and second trimesters who are using Falmouth town water. As you know, there's going to be a $46 million water treatment system going in a couple of years. But right now they have to treat the drinking water with chlorine because it all comes out of Long Pond. Long Pond is an open air source. There's a lot of biology and waste in there, so they do have to treat that water with chlorine. A byproduct of that is two chemicals that have been associated with early delivery and low birth weight in some studies that have been done. So for women in their first and second trimesters, the Board of Health sort of reiterated the potential risk. It's a small risk, if it is even a risk, but that association is there, so they are reminding the public of that.
So were those levels above any type of state or federal standards?
Yes. Some test results that were actually released back in the fall showed that the levels of, I'm going to try to pronounce these, triethylamines and haloacetic acids were both above limits that were set by the EPA. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's an average of the previous four quarters of testing. So it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, they take a long view of it because the levels can spike depending on what's going on with the pond and then be really low. So they take a long view of it. And the results that came in last fall triggered that those violations of the last year's worth of testing.
So they got the results last fall. Why are we hearing about it now?
Well, because this is a time of year when the byproducts from this chlorine cleaning, essentially, of the water can be higher because there's more biological activity in the pond. So The test results they're going on right now won't be known for a while, and they might not trigger an EPA violation. But it's the time of year, spring and summer, where we might be more likely to see that creeping into the water. So sort of a reiteration, they had sent out a letter back in the fall to local doctors. They're probably going to do so again. So it was just more of another reminder about awareness of it.
And what should people be doing?
Well, if they're concerned, filtering your water, like a charcoal filter, like a Brita pitcher, does get rid of these byproducts. The trouble is, though, is that in the last couple of months, another study has come out that shows that they can be present in water vapor. So if you're taking a hot shower, you can absorb it in that way. So ultimately, the only way to address it is a whole house charcoal filter system, which can be expensive. They're not easy to install. But, you know, ultimately that or cold showers, you know, are sort of your only options if you're someone who could be affected by this.
And if people have more questions about that, I believe it's the Falmouth Board of Health that is taking the lead on this, so they should probably contact them if they have more questions that particular issue. I can see if you're pregnant, you'd be concerned. Let's talk about first, I want to go back to the district attorney story for just a moment. You mentioned that his opponent in the election cried cronyism in a tweet on Twitter. I just want to ask, but that's not proven. Did the Cape Cod, as far as I know, the Cape Cod Times checked whether there were any donations from the owner of that fish market to the district attorney, and there have been no political donations.
Not to the district attorney, though.
I see.
Political donations to prominent Republicans, but not to Mr. O'Keefe directly, according to Georgia Story.
Okay, I just want to make sure we got that in there. Let's talk about the former superintendent of the town of Sandwich. Again, another story we've been going over several times as the former superintendent defendant has been locked in legal battle with the school committee in the town of Sandwich. Bring us back. Tell us how this all started.
Oh, goodness. Well, this is another one that George Brennan has been following for a long time. But essentially, Mary Ellen Johnson, the former superintendent of Sandwich Schools, was the school board after an election changed their mind about a contract extension, I believe, and that ended up being called a breach of contract after it went through court. So they've been trying to hammer out a settlement now.
It was a whole confusing situation. Because a school committee says, yes, we're going to extend the superintendent's contract. Then we have there's a town election that's held. New committee members come in and they say, no, we're not going to extend the contract. And then it becomes a question of whether the first vote was properly posted, whether it was an open meeting violation. And I believe the town got some legal advice that said that is an open meeting violation. You need to re-vote. And in the re-vote, they said, no, we're not going to extend the contract.
Right.
So she took it to court. The surprising thing was we hear a settlement, I think the second settlement that has come up, $500,000, we hear from her attorneys, that we're going to go forward with that. And then we read in the paper today,
nope.
No.
Right. Well, George Brennan talked to Mary Ellen Johnson, and she said that she called it a miscommunication, said that she was presented with papers, but she had not agreed to sign them. And it seems like she's still concerned about the damage to her reputation that this entire affair has done, and that I don't think that she feels, it seems like she doesn't feel that the settlement does enough to address that. How you could do that, I'm not sure, but that seems to be what she's been telling George. And also there's a matter in there, I think, of she has to agree to drop any future claims against the town, and it seems like she wasn't. There might be a hang up on that also.
Yeah, it's not clear from the reporting that we've seen so far exactly what she is seeking from the town, but she is implying that yes,
right.
She's having trouble finding another job. But she's also been chastised, I believe, by the judge who has overseen this case in terms of whether it keeps coming back and keeps coming back.
I mean, the judge has, from my recollection, said that he. Basically, he has warned her that she's, done enough, that her legal actions on this have not been appropriate, even though she won, essentially, and she's, they're offering her settlements, and whatever it is that she wants is not this.
Earlier this week in the story that George wrote about the settlement, the $500,000 settlement, there seemed to be a great sigh of relief among members of the town officials in the town of Sandwich saying, we got to move on from this thing. So they're probably reading today's paper thinking, we thought we were moving on, but there's more legal work to be done in the town of Sandwich.
As they say, it ain't over till it's over.
All right. On that, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll, a reporter with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. Welcome back to The Point. Let's talk about the Monomoy Refuge Master Plan. Give us the background on what that plan is all about and how. And then, of course, there's some news on that.
Sure. The plan was released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service back in April. Basically, it's a 15 to 20-year management plan that proposes a number of management options for Monomoy, the refuge that is located down on the southern tip of Chatham. Most of the recommendations deal with the main mission of the refuge, which is to protect nesting shorebirds. Several of the elements of the plan, however, have been very controversial in Chatham. And in the latest development, the selectmen here are preparing a letter to State Attorney General Martha Coakley asking her office to intervene. Specifically, they want her to intervene and help them fight the Fish and Wildlife Service on two controversial aspects of the management plan. The first is the taking. The Fish and Wildlife's assertion that they own 717 acres of South Beach, which up to now has been owned by the town. And the other one is the assertion of by the Fish and Wildlife Service of Management control over the waters and the undersea area west of the island, management mostly being involving fisheries, but other issues as well, such as recreational use, kiteboarding, and things like that. In a draft letter that the selectmen have been looking at, they say that they try to convince Coakley to intervene by saying the state has an interest in the issue because ever since Monomoy was became a national wildlife refuge 70 years ago, those waters, the fisheries and shell fisheries, have been managed by the town and the state using local and state regulations, and now suddenly Fish and Wildlife want to assert their management control, and the town is saying that this isn't right and that the feds have no business doing this. The selectmen also want to take advantage of the AG's investigative powers because a number of the underlying legal opinions and documentation that Fish and Wildlife Service are relying on for these assertions have yet to be released either to the town or publicly. And now the letter is still in draft form. The selectmen are scheduled to review it on Tuesday, and they'll most likely vote to send it out at that time. After that, at that point, we'll see if the AG's office is interested in intervening, you know, given that Martha Coakley is running for governor, and this is a pretty high-profile situation. You know, there's a pretty good chance that they might intervene. But the selectmen in the letter make it clear that with or without the AG, they're willing to take these two issues specifically as far as they can, including taking the federal government to court.
Hmm. Are the selectmen pretty much unified in their opposition to the what's been called the taking of these 700-plus acres?
Yes, there's pretty much universal opposition to that among the selectmen. And, you know, there hasn't been any real much support on these two issues for the Fish and Wildlife Service among residents of the town. You know, as you remember, there was a big public hearing last month where there was about 200 people showed up to give comment on the plan. About 35 or so actually spoke. And while, you know, people are opposed to what they see as a far-reaching sort of a power grab by the feds, they also indicated that there, you know, there's some willingness to work together on this plan. That's Fish and Wildlife feel that there's some leeway here, some negotiation that could happen. Nothing of that ilk has taken place yet, but I know Fish and Wildlife. I talked to Libby Herland, who's the director of the wildlife of the Monomoy and other refuges in the southeast southeastern Mass, and she's confident that there could be some compromises reached here.
Okay. Let's talk about the Cape Cod Baseball League. Of course, you're located in Chatham. The Chatham A's are the local team there. Some news about a new Cape Cod Baseball League video service.
Sure. This report comes to us from our sports guy, Eric Adler, who talked to Randy Flores, who was a former Chatham A's pitcher back in 1995, I think, and went on to pitch for the St. Louis Cardinals, and was most famously played a role in their 2006 World Series victory. He's founded a California-based company called On Deck Digital. And what they've done is they've reached a agreement with the Cape League where they've put high definition video cameras at each game of the season for all the teams in the league, and they record the games. Once the games are recorded and uploaded and processed, they're available on demand via subscription, a subscription-based service. What's different about this service is that you can subscribe to follow a single player, a single team, or a single game. And all the games, they've developed a technology where they condense the games by removing the downtime between innings or even between pitches. So you can watch a game in much less time than you would do it in real time. The benefit of this is if you're off Cape and you have a son who's playing in the league, you can tune in, you can watch the whole game in a short time, or you can just watch your son's at bats. And the system also is collecting information such as pitch speed and batting counts and other data that that has helped catch the interest of some Major League Baseball clubs and some coaches, some media outlets, and of course many parents. They're not saying how many subscribers they have at this point, but Randy Flores says that it's doing pretty well. It's not a cheap service. Subscriptions begin at $19.95 per month and go up from there. But it is available on different platforms. You can view it on your smartphone or your tablet. And at this point, the Cape League is the first organization that On Deck Digital is working with. Randy Flores indicates that he's like to extend that out to more amateur leagues and other services. And we'll have to see how their success goes this season and whether it grows from there.
Mm. And it's an interesting service. Thanks for talking about that. And you make some good points about who could use that. Of course,
sure.
Those games are such a slice of Americana and such an important part of the summer here on Cape Cod to attend a Cape Cod
sure.
Baseball League game.
And, you know, the most Cape League teams also offer internet services, either video or voice streaming. But this is high definition. This is, taking advantage of current technology. It's really, really nice stuff. It's like a next step up for those who are really into the game.
All right. Thank you, Tim Wood. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. You can follow Tim on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay. Let's go to Joshua Balling. He's with the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. He's the assistant editor there as well as director of digital content at the newspaper. Hello, Josh.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Now, it was Nantucket that really felt the storm, the 4th of July storm last week. How did the island do?
We ended up coming through it basically fine. I can't say unscathed, but yes, we really did get the brunt of the storm, being a little bit further out to sea than most of the Cape. Hurricane Arthur whipped through on Friday night, brought with it really driving rain and high winds. They peaked at about 80 miles an hour, and it was blowing 50 to 60 for a good couple hours from around 9 to 11 o'clock. There was a lot of flooded roads and basements. A lot of tree limbs came down. The town officials, emergency preparedness officials, opened up an emergency shelter at Nantucket High School around 8 o'clock once the transportation by boat and plane off the island was canceled. They were really concerned that there might be hundreds of people stranded on the island, not able to get back to the mainland based on the large crowds that were here for the 4th. There might have been, but they found other accommodations. The shelter only served 17 people compared to the Vineyard shelter, which served 180. That wasn't too bad. They were more than able to keep up with that. But it was quite a storm anyway, certainly unusual for this time of year. More than 2,750 homes lost electricity for several hours. They were able to get that restored by morning again, but there were a couple of transformer fires and one house fire at the height of the storm as well. The fire department, police department, emergency services were very busy, and while most of the people were enjoying a nice Saturday after the storm blew through, one of the benefits of it being a fast-moving storm is it was out of here by daybreak. A lot of cleanup was going on Saturday into Sunday while people were still enjoying their weekends.
I saw a picture I think you tweeted which had some boats that appeared to have got loose from their moorings.
About 50 boats total were beached, most on the western side of Nantucket Harbor, some piled on top of each other, a couple others capsized or sunk. We found out later that a lot more danger was averted. However, there was a 110-foot power yacht that dragged its 4,000-pound anchor a good distance before its crew was able to secure a couple of mooring balls and come to a stop. We had one boater who told us who was spending the night on his boat that had that motor yacht gone unencumbered across the harbor, it would have taken out dozens more boats like bowling pins. That could have been some serious problems, but fortunately the crew was on top of it. They were able to snag some mooring balls and get that boat stopped before it caused any more significant damage. Most of those boats back on their moorings, only minor damage. Really, for the magnitude of the storm and how fast it blew through, other than a lot of downed tree limbs, a lot of flooded basements, including my own, there wasn't any significant damage that couldn't be repaired or cleaned up relatively quickly.
I hadn't realized that the winds had hit 80 miles per hour. I thought that it was 60, which, you know, Nantucket experiences quite often throughout the year.
We do, not necessarily in July, not necessarily when there may be 50 or 60,000 people here who aren't necessarily used to it. There was a lot of people out even into the darkness on Friday night checking out the storm. The emergency preparedness people, the firefighters and police officers urging people to not get so close to downed tree limbs and downed power lines, but a lot of people are curious about the storm.
And when I was asking you what you wanted to discuss this morning on the news roundup, you mentioned in your note to me the mayhem of the 4th of July. What do you mean by mayhem?
Well, it's come to become something of a tradition, maybe not a popular one out on Nantucket. On the 4th of July, there's a massive beach party on the South Shore on Nobodyer Beach, and no different this year, even with Hurricane Arthur bearing down. About 2,000 people, mostly young people, college students, young people, gather on the beach for a big 4th of July party. We allow beach driving on Nantucket. There's a lot of cars. There's tons of people. We had a photo that Nicole Harnischwiger, one of our photographers, took from a bluff over the beach, and it's just a mass, seething mass of people as far as you can see, which is not what you usually see on the beaches of Nantucket. You might see it at Daytona Beach or down on the Jersey Shore sometimes, but not here on Nantucket. It's one day a year. There were a number of incidents, mostly related to alcohol, a couple of ambulance calls on Friday, but no major injuries, number of arrests, but nothing serious. Police were saying that about the same as in past years, a little bit less alcohol, perhaps a little bit less rowdiness, maybe because of the storm, but a lot of trash. And that is something that the residents of Surfside and the surrounding neighborhoods are not happy about. They don't mind a big party once in a while, but they just wish that the partiers would take out what they brought in and leave the beach the way they found it, rather than looking like a little bit of a garbage dump the next morning.
Oh, that's understandable, that people would want them to clean up after themselves. Josh, I did see that photo you referenced, I believe, on your Twitter feed, and people can follow your Twitter feed at JBallingIM. And of course, Joshua Balling is the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the newspaper. Josh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And on the phone now joining us is Jeff Spillane. He's a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. How are you, Jeff?
Hey, good morning, Sean and John.
Yes.
Good morning.
The Seans are here. And let's talk about a new e-cigarette or vaporizer shop coming to Mashpee. Vaporizer, that's for marijuana? What's the deal?
No, it's actually a nationwide trend that is finally arriving here on the Cape. And it's called vaping, which really is smoking without tobacco. And it does involve e-cigarettes. And a trend across the country is to have these vaping boutiques. And there is one opening in Mashpee on August 1st. And what it involves is buying, for lack of a better word, the hardware, which is the e-cigarette, and there's several different types of that, and they start at $28. But the interesting part of this is you select the flavor that you want to vaporize or smoke and add the amount of nicotine that you'd like to put in there. And this is a company called The Vapeway, which has a store in Plymouth, which I spoke with the owner and said it's been doing very well for the past year, and they've been getting a lot of customers on the Cape. And they decided to open a store on Route 151. And very interesting thing, nobody seems to know whether or not this is safe or not. The owner of the store is saying we're getting a lot of people in who want to quit smoking, they want to kick the tobacco habit, so they are using these vaporizers and picking out any type of flavor. I mean, on their website the other day, the flavor of the day was something called Monkey Punch, which is a mixture of pomegranate and raspberry. And speaking with a doctor, Dr. David Tager, over at the Cape Cod Community Health Center in Mashpee, he says, you know, saying these things are a safe alternative to smoking and kicking the habit, it's just not proven yet. The FDA is not regulating this and could possibly be a gateway to getting people addicted to nicotine.
Interesting story there. Okay, we'll have to see how well that business does. Jeff, your phone line is a little rough, but I think we're going to hang with you. If it gets really bad, we might have to drop out. But tell me about this new weather station at Mashpee High School. It's part of this STEM initiative.
That's right. A weather station was installed at Mashpee High School this week. It's part of the Weather Bug Initiative, which is affiliated with WBZ in Boston. That's the CBS affiliate in town. Mm-hmm. It will provide real-time live weather reports right from the softball field at Mashpee High School. And it also will have a lightning-to-ground detector. So it will be used not only to teach students, but to provide meteorologists up in the Boston area with real-time data as to what's happening here on the Cape.
That'll be good for the students. And, of course, this weekend coming up is Pirate Palooza. That's a big event in the town of Mashpee.
It is. It's the second annual Pirate Palooza. That is put on by the Mashpee Chamber of Commerce. It kicks off tomorrow, and it will be at South Cape Village. Starts tomorrow morning with what they're calling a Thieves Marketplace, which is an arts and crafts fair. And at 10 o'clock tomorrow, it will kick off with a parade. When they are actually encouraging adults, children, and dogs to come dressed as pirates. And then it all culminate tomorrow night with the Pirate Ball at Saltgate Village.
Can the dogs go to the ball as well?
The dogs can't go to the ball, no. Oh. It says adults only.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you cleared that up.
We'll be parading tomorrow.
All right, Jeff. Jeff Spillane is a reporter with the Mashpee Enterprise. Thanks for joining us, Jeff.
All right, you're welcome.
Okay, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll. And so we mentioned Pirate Palooza is coming up in Mashpee tomorrow. And, of course, the Cape Cod Times has a listing on its A2 section, A2 page every single day about things that are going on the Cape and Islands. And so people can take a look at that if they're looking for other things to do.
Non-pirate-related thing.
As right. well as non-pirate.
Yes, pirate and non-pirate items on that page.
Okay, we're going to take just a quick break. And when we come back, I'm told that Nelson Siegelman will join us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Hello.
And welcome back to The Point. We appreciate you being here. We were just talking with Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. He was talking about how we did on Nantucket with the storm. They had to open a shelter. Martha's Vineyard opened a shelter as well during the 4th of July storm.
Yes, this was a pretty interesting drill, if you will. It was quite unusual. There were a number of people over for a day trip. They were mostly Chinese Americans from New York. The head of the tour agency told me he had about 400 people in total come to the vineyard on Friday, and about half of them got off the island before the last boats canceled. And suddenly the steamship terminal had close to 200 people in it, the Vineyard Haven terminal, and they didn't quite know what they were going to do with them all. But the Tisbury Police, Oak Bluffs Police, and the EMTs, Fire Rescue, the Red Cross, the various emergency management directors, they all got together pretty quickly, and they rounded up cots, and they created shelters at the Tisbury School Gym and also the Oak Bluffs School Gym. So it worked out well, and those people went home with, I'm sure, interesting story to tell about their one-day trip to Martha's Vineyard.
Probably makes it much more memorable.
I would think so. Of course, you do have to question. The tour operator who I spoke with in New York said he thought there should have been more pre-warning from the Steamship Authority, but of course, it's hard to understand how he could have been unaware that a hurricane was moving up the coast, and we are an island, and the steamship folks told me that they did, in fact, tell these people. They tried to get them to leave earlier, but a lot of the various tourists were roaming around the different towns.
Mm. And another news.
Speaking of tourists.
Go ahead. Good transition. Go ahead.
Yeah. Speaking of tourists, guess who's coming to the Martha's Vineyard in August, right?
I believe that would be President Obama and his family once again.
Yes. We learned late Wednesday afternoon, we got official confirmation from the White House of what we pretty much knew since March, that the president was going to visit Martha's Vineyard in August. They confirmed the dates, August 9th to August 24th. And our enterprising intern reporter, Nathaniel Horowitz, went up to the neighborhood where he heard the president was going to stay and, in fact, confirmed it. So we were able to describe the house in all its splendor. It'll be on the island's north shore. Beautiful views of Vineyard Sound and the Elizabeth Islands in the distance, and looks like a pretty nice place to stay from the photo that he took.
Well, folks can go to your website, the Martha's Vineyard Times website, and see that photo, and congratulations on the work of that enterprising intern. And thank you very much, Nelson. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Driscoll, a reporter with the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Let's talk about a story in the paper this week about hours cut for the island's only juvenile probation officer. That's a Martha's Vineyard story as well, right?
Yes, it is. And the probation officer who had been spending the majority of his – a juvenile probation officer spending the majority of his time on Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard – was reassigned to Falmouth by the state, and now he'll only spend one day every other week on the islands. And understandably, the law enforcement officials on both islands are upset about this because of the work he was doing there. They feel like they're going to be underserved, even though obviously there is a, well, there is a shortage of these officers, and they're trying to shuffle to meet the demand. But if you're on Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, you probably feel pretty shortchanged by that.
Okay, and there was some sad news in the paper today about former Barnstable Town Councilor Richard Clark, and he was in a scuba diving accident.
Yes, and this is very sad and a strange story, but he was scuba diving off the coast of North Carolina late last month and was on a recreational dive down to see a shipwreck, but he never got to the ocean floor. And the Coast Guard launched a search for him, and it came up with no result, so he is presumed dead. They did not, doesn't seem like they found a body anywhere at this point, but they didn't find him, and he hasn't shown up anywhere. So he's presumed dead at this point. It's a very sad story.
Experienced, was he a scuba diver?
Yes, he was avid. He enjoyed it, and since retiring, he split his time between, you know, here, Barnstable on the Cape and Florida, and he was a well-practiced scuba diver, so knew what he was doing. So we don't obviously know what happened, but he was not a novice.
The former Truro police chief was back in the news again, unfortunately, and again, it's alcohol related.
It is, yes. John Lundborn, who was the Truro police chief for not very long in 2011, but was arrested last week for when police responded to the McDonald's restaurant on North Street in Hyannis, which is very close to downtown. A caller reported a suspicious man stumbling around the parking lot with a small child before he got into his black Chevy Tahoe. Police arrived, and they saw him backing out and trying to get onto North Street, and they stopped the car, and it turned out to be Lundborn, who's, this is not the first time, unfortunately, he's been arrested on an alcohol-related charge.
And, of course, to have the child there, of course, makes it even more serious, I would imagine. And of course, it goes back to the original story. We first learned about the chief and some of the troubles there when he was found in a vehicle, what was that, three years ago when he was police chief?
Right. He was named police chief in June 2011, according to this article by Amy Anthony. And in October of that year, he crashed a brand-new police cruiser into a tree in North Truro. He later resigned and then admitted sufficient facts in court to an OUI charge, negligent driving, and was placed on probation. And so he, you know, his struggles with alcohol, you know, date back at least that far. But he had been on the police department for 22 years before he resigned after his short stint as chief.
Okay, let's move on to another chief of sorts. This is a school chief in Nauset who has been having some difficulties with the school committee there, and we weren't sure whether his contract was going to be extended. Now it appears he is going to be retiring.
Yes, I'm having a theme in the news this week about school superintendents, but Richard Hoffman, who is the chief at Nauset, the superintendent at Nauset, says that his current contract is up July 1st of 2015. Now he said that he will retire on August 15th of 2015. Of course, the school committee will have to approve a six-week contract extension, and that is yet to be done. But there has been, you know...
Well, why the 6 weeks?
Well, as it turns out, that a pension decision, he consulted with the Massachusetts Teachers Retirement System, and that would give him the maximum amount of 80% of his salary. So he's just short of being able to max out his pension. When he were wanting to retire, he needs that 6 weeks to get to that hump. So that's why he wants to stay on for the extra month and a half. He currently earns about $168,000. And if he doesn't work that 6 weeks, he would just get a little bit less in his pension. So he's figures he's that close to the finish line. He wants to get there. But it'll depend on the school committee if they want to give him that 6 weeks or not. And obviously they also will have to start looking for a new superintendent after he leaves.
And it's not uncommon for superintendents to find themselves at odds with the school committee. And what can we encapsulate what this has kind of been about?
Well, Casey Myers has been following this story. I know that they did, in looking at the story that was in this week, they had some negative evaluations of him in May, and he's had some mounting criticism from school committee members, accusing him of poor leadership and weak communication skills. And that morale at school district has been low. So morale, there just seems to be strife between him and other leaders. So it just it seems like people agree that it's time for change. Just exactly when that change will happen is up for debate at this point.
Time for a change, yeah. A very strong school system there, that Nauset school system. Let's look to Boren, back on the other side of the Cape now, where there is a development project proposed or in the works. It's kind of hard to say sometimes.
Right. It's it's proposed to be in the works, now. But there's a $55 million seven-story mixed-use complex that they want to put in Buzzards Bay. And the team behind that, in a concern about a sewer commission, with the sewer commission and wastewater, they're going to build a brand-name hotel first before doing the larger part of the project, because there's a concern about the town's capacity to treat and dispose of wastewater. They have the developers that initially asked for 30,000 gallons of wastewater capacity a day. Now they're saying 46,000, and the entire town only gets 200,000 gallons of wastewater per day. So that's a pretty big chunk of what they're allowed to send. They don't have their own wastewater facility there. They send it to Wareham. So they're concerned that this development will take up a big chunk of their allotment. So as a concession to that, they're doing the smaller project first, and to allow... Well, that's what they're talking about anyway, to allow for some more time to sort of sort out these issues and let the town and the developers figure out a way to make it happen.
What is the bigger project? So start with the hotel, perhaps?
Perhaps.
And what would ultimately be the build-out?
Well, the build-out would be, it's a seven-story mixed-use complex, so it would have some retail and some apartments, condos, living up top, something that would have... 144 residential units, in fact, and a rooftop restaurant overlooking the canal. Ooh. So nice views. I'm sure rent will be very modest, probably.
Well, that area could certainly use a
Certainly could use a boost, yeah. I mean, housing is tight, so that would be a nice view, but it's going to be a pretty big build-out out there. So they're still working out all the details of that.
Okay. Rail trail, that's something used quite a bit by locals and visitors as well. That's the bicycle trail that runs through much of Cape Cod. Making it bigger, extending it?
Another 3.7 miles. So they're going to extend it from South Dennis West to Peter Homer Park in South Yarmouth, which is a pretty good chunky to be able to go from Yarmouth to Wellfleet once it's built. And they're sending it out to bid. It's a $9 million expansion. The first phase of it, they're going to put out to bid by September. And then the next phase will be put out to bid by February. So the hope is that this would be wrapped up by 2016 or 2017, so in the next couple of years.
So we don't know when any indication about when the work would happen, whether that would be... off season or what?
Christine Legere has been following this. It seems like they will. It probably would be ongoing to get that done. But the big timing thing about this is, if it isn't advertised by the end of September, they could lose some funding for it. So they've got to get it going now and work on both phases. This will be done simultaneously and finish about the same time. So the whole trail, when it's done, will be open, and you could. Enjoy that all the way from South Yarmouth up to Wellfleet at that point. So
I know there's been a lot of talk on the Cape for many years about trying to connect all the communities with some sort of rail trail, and we're making progress, it appears. And Falmouth does pretty well here. There's quite a trail here, the Shining Sea Bikeway,
Shining Sea obviously gets you from Woods Hole up on into Falmouth, and there are, like you said, bits and pieces of trails everywhere, and this is... probably the longest, I don't know this off the top of my head, but a pretty long chunk from Yarmouth up to Wellfleet. So, there are these little sections of old rail that are around and aren't being used as much more. So it just takes time and money and planning. But this will be a big chunk of it if they can get it done. It'll be nice, especially for mid to lower Cape folks.
Okay. Let's talk about Nobsco Light, which, of course, the lighthouse right here in Woods Hole.
Yes.
And did you write this story?
I did, yes.
So what's up? Now, we'd heard that they were looking to... right now, Nobsco Light is controlled by the Coast Guard.
It is, and it's sort of a complicated mixture of the Coast Guard, and, because it's a landmark, the the historic people. But the Coast Guard indicated that it may be up for sale. It is not actually up for sale, but it has to be placed on a list for divestiture before it can be up for sale because it's the government, so it's never easy. But now they've offered basically a licensing option for nonprofits or government groups who might want to get in there. And what that means is that the Coast Guard would continue to own it. They will continue to run the lights and the foghorn regardless of what happens. That's not going away. But for no rent, a nonprofit group or groups or government could get in there. They have to agree to upgrade it, basically fix what's wrong and maintain it. But then they could run a program from there, a gift shop or some sort of museum or whatever, without having to pay rent. So in exchange for doing the upgrades and the upkeep, then they could get in there to do a program from there. A lot of stipulations involved. It's not a simple process because, again, it's the federal government. But there are some nonprofits in town. After meeting last month with a Coast Guard representative, there's three nonprofits that seem to sort of be rising to the top of the heap. The Falmouth Historical Society, Highfield Hall and Greens, and the Woods Hole Historical Museum all seem to be the ones who are most likely to take the lead on putting in an application for this licensing option, and probably in conjunction with the town. But it's not baked yet, but it needs to bake very soon. They need to get an application, or at least a sort of a letter of interest in by early August.
And so Nobska, you have the lighthouse there, mm-hmm. very popular. It's in a wonderful location in Woods Hole. You can pull up, you can park, you can check it out. But there's also a building that's associated with it as well. I believe that's where the traditionally commandants of the Coast Guard have lived. Is that included in this?
Yes. It's everything that's on that property. So the building, there's a shed or an outbuilding, and then the lighthouse building itself. So it would all be part of this licensing option. But if anyone ends up taking it under that, they still have to preserve public access. They can't start charging admission necessarily. They can have a free will donation, but you can't charge admission for it. And the Coast Guard obviously still has to be able to access it whenever they want to. So it is all of those buildings on there. So it would be a lot of work. I mean, Nobska is not in great shape. The house isn't in great shape. You know, it's on the edge of the ocean. So it has taken a literal and figurative beating over the year. So there would be a lot of work needed to be done to get it fixed up and to maintain it. It would not be a cheap proposition. But, you know, there's a huge, you know, need from the community to preserve it and to keep it going. So there seems to be a will. It's just, what is the way?
And your reporting so far is that it doesn't appear likely that it would be an individual that would be able to step in there.
No, it does. The licensing option does have to go to a nonprofit or a government. If they were to put it up for sale, which they still could, even if they license it, it would have to be offered first to nonprofits, governments, that kind of thing. If no one takes them up on it, or there's not a, you know, it's not just going to be to any nonprofit. So it has to, you know, the Coast Guard and everyone has to approve of whatever the plan is that they want to put in there. Then it could go to auction and maybe get sold, but that would be a long process. And I have to believe that, given all the conversations I've had with people in town, that they would find a way to make sure it's not going to turn into condos. It's not going to get closed off. It's a public, it's a landmark, it's part of the community, and people want to make sure it stays that way.
One final question on this. Woods Hole has a very strong community group, mm-hmm. association. Have they expressed any interest?
They have been leading discussions, but they themselves are not, they want to be involved in support from what I've, you know, conversations I've had, but they are not the kind of organization that can really take on the kind of fundraising and responsibility that this is. These three organizations I mentioned, they have buildings, they do big capital campaigns and go out for grants. They're the kind of organization that probably needs to take the lead in terms of raising the money to keep the lighthouse going.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I want to thank Sean Driscoll, a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online, who joined me in our Woods Hole studio. His first appearance on The Point. How did it go, Sean?
Well, I'm here, and I didn't say anything bad on live radio.
No.
So.
Every time you don't curse, it's a victory.
Right. I know it is, and I believe I told the truth as best as I know. know what about everything. So it was great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you, Sean. And folks can follow Sean on Twitter at Sean F. Driscoll. And of course, the Sean is S-E-A-N and F as in Frank Driscoll. Thanks to our other contributors, of course, Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jeff Spillane of the Mashpee Enterprise, and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you all for participating. And of course, I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.